Welcome to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. I'm Kelly Romaris. Today's topic is Bioterrorism, Looking in the Mirror. When I booted up my AOL account on the morning of December 11th, I was greeted by the picture of someone in a gas mask and the headline, "You gas us, we'll nuke you." Bad as that was, the headline on one of my local newspapers, the West County Times, was worse. Preemptive nuke strike a possibility. The San Francisco Chronicle banner headline was even pithier. Bush Doctrine, hit first. Whenever George W. Bush talks about Saddam Hussein and Iraq, I can't help but think that he could easily be talking about himself and the United States.
Members of Congress of both political parties and members of the United Nations Security Council agree that Saddam Hussein is a threat to peace and must disarm. We agree that the Iraqi dictator must not be permitted to threaten America and the world with horrible poisons and diseases and gases and atomic weapons. Since we all agree on this goal, the issue is, how best can we achieve it?
Since Bush proclaims himself to be a Christian, I suggest that he might take a giant step toward that goal by getting out his Bible and reading Matthew chapter 7, verses 3, 4, and 5. "And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, Let me pull out the mote out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye? Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then thou shalt see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye." Indeed, while Bush threatens war against Iraq for developing and maintaining weapons of mass destruction, including biological weapons, the United States government has a national plan to increase the number of Biohazard Safety Level, or BSL, 3 and 4 labs. These high-containment facilities handle the world's most dangerous organisms. BSL-3 labs handle anthrax, botulism, and bubonic plague, among many others. BSL-4 labs are even worse. They handle smallpox and Ebola virus, among other deadly organisms. Steve Erickson is the director of the Citizens Education Project in Salt Lake City, Utah. It's a nonprofit that educates the public on issues of social, environmental, and economic justice. The Citizens Education Project is part of a coalition of nonprofit organizations that is calling upon Congress and the public for an urgent reassessment of the nation's biodefense program. When I spoke with Erickson, he was on his cell phone in the halls of the Utah State Capitol.
Can you give me a description of the proliferation of these BSL labs, that there's going to be more threes and fours? Particularly, is this a response to 9/11, or is this something that's been in the planning for years?
Oh, it's our sense that this expansion of laboratory capacity within the Defense Department and other departments of government has been in the works for a number of years, probably dating to about 1995. Certainly, the intensity and speed of these developments has picked up since 9/11, 2001.
Any figures on how many they plan to build?
Well, the last count we had was about 14 that were being proposed in various locations by any one of four major cabinet-level departments within the U.S. government. There are some indications now that the National Institutes of Health will be backing off in terms of the numbers of biological safety level 4 laboratories, but intends instead to renovate and perhaps build additional biological level 3 laboratories.
I noticed that the members of this coalition are all from the western states. Is there a desire to dump these things in the west?
No, I think that's more coincidence, and just that we tend to network better amongst ourselves, perhaps. There are also labs being proposed in the east, and in particular, those associated with U.S. AMRIT at Fort Detrick, which is the Army's end of the biological defense research programs.
And didn't we tie the anthrax attacks to that organization?
Well, that's certainly the allegation and the suspicion, and that would include also perhaps involvement by the Dugway Proving Ground, which is under the authority of U.S. AMRIT. Also perhaps the Battelle Corporation, a contractor with the Army and the DOD.
The what corporation?
Battelle, B-A-T-E-L-L-E. They're headquartered in Columbus.
Ohio.
Ohio, yes.
How is it going with educating the citizens? Are they responding?
Well, I think that we're getting the information out. Whether or not it will have much of an impact immediately on the plans to expand missions and activities at Dugway remains to be seen. But recently, Utah State University, which had proposed to chase after the funding for a biological safety level 4 laboratory, has decided to withdraw from that process. So maybe he's making a little progress.
That was Steve Erickson, director of the Citizens Education Project in Salt Lake City, Utah. The project's website is www.citizensedproject.org. That's citizensedproject.org. The Department of Energy wants to build a new BSL-3 facility at Lawrence Livermore National Lab in the San Francisco suburb of Livermore. The lab, which is run by the University of California, is a nuclear research facility. This planned mix of nuclear and biological research troubles Dr. Barbara Hatch Rosenberg. She's the chair of the Working Group on Biological Weapons of the Federation of American Scientists. Having different kinds of research in one facility, she says, makes oversight difficult.
Lawrence Livermore conducts research on other weapons systems, classified research. And when various types of weapons are being researched at the same place, it means that if there is any kind of oversight or investigation or inspection of one type, it puts at risk classified information about the others. And this is a reason why this government frequently objects to any kind of oversight. And this is also, in my view, a reason why different kinds of weapon research should be conducted at different locations rather than piling them all in the same place. And the second point I'd like to make is that the reason that we have had an anthrax attack recently is that someone in biodefense research had access to dangerous agents and had the knowledge of how to weaponize them and use them for his own purposes. By multiplying the number of laboratories and individuals working in them who have access to these agents and knowledge of how to handle them, we are simply multiplying the possibility of future attacks of the same kind coming from inside our own system. Now, this may sound unlikely, but when you look at the history of the laboratory that's the probable source of the anthrax attacks, which is the Army's Infectious Disease Laboratory at Fort Detrick, Maryland, it has had an incredible history of poor oversight, childish activities, unauthorized access, and all sorts of accidents that that made what happened almost inevitable. And that was at our premier laboratory for doing this kind of work. So as we multiply the number of places that are doing the same kind of thing, the chances of proper oversight are going to decrease substantially. And in spite of what I hope are new restrictions and rules, I don't see how we're going to be able to do better all over the country than we've been able to do at our one most important laboratory. So I think the plans to build a large number of high-containment laboratories sprinkled across the country are a mistake and are going to decrease rather than increase public safety. That research on dangerous agents should be carried out at a small number of highly secure sites with very strong oversight and supervision.
You were quoted in the Oakland Tribune on July 27th, which is how I got the idea to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, also, the Livermore Lab Deputy Counterterrorism Director, Paige Stoutland, was also quoted. As I was pursuing the story this week, I found that not only was I getting bounced around from one media person to another and a couple of them wanting to know specifically what I wanted to ask, but ultimately they decided that they wanted nobody on record and they just faxed me some paperwork about some of the safety concerns that I had raised. What's your reaction to that?
I suppose that they're aware that there is some criticism out there. not just in the community where there's concern about safety, I suppose, as their primary concern, but also among scientists around the country, who some scientists at least, who feel that this is a mistake, that we are going in the wrong direction if what we're trying to do is increase public safety. I suppose that they're just trying to avoid getting into some kind of dispute over that, but I do think it's a foolish move. I mean, after all, it's what they do is done with public money, and they should be accountable to the public and should be willing to stand up and provide their arguments for doing what they want to do and take their chances as to whether they can be talked down by someone else.
I had suggested to them, at least I had talked to one of the environmentalists, and who raised a concern that Lawrence Livermore was a nuclear facility and not equipped to handle or experienced enough to handle biowarfare agents. And the one bit of information I did get was that they'd had a biosafety level 2 lab there for a number of years. So now they're moving to 3, which is more hazardous material. Are we seeing these, I don't know if the proper word is upgrading, of facilities to higher levels of more dangerous contaminants throughout the country?
Yes, yes. In fact, the highest level is BL4, and the plan is to double the number of BL4 laboratories in the country and to increase the number of BL3. Now, BL2 is just really an ordinary microbiology laboratory. When you get into BL3, you're talking about higher containment and more dangerous agents. And I think, first of all, the fact that they have been doing some work at Lawrence Livermore in this field has been a mistake all along. But if there ever is to be a change, now is the time to do it before they spend a lot of money upgrading that facility. And it's the BL3 is much, much more expensive and requires much, much more equipment and so on than a BL2. So I don't think that that's a very good argument.
It seems to me that if you're going to develop a defense against a biowarfare agent, you have to know how that germ or virus or whatever it is works. And then it's a very thin line between, you know, making an offensive weapon and making a defensive weapon. How can we be sure that they're not making offensive weapons, which are illegal, as opposed to defensive weapons, which are?
Well, that's a very good point. And I think that there is one overriding rule to use in a case like this, and that is openness. Any work that's being done secretly that seems to be on the very edge of or over the line of legitimacy will be assumed to be illegitimate unless it's done openly. I think that any work that's done openly that may be close to the line, as long as the world knows that it's being done, that is the best guarantee we can have. And that doesn't mean that we have to tell the world what the results are, but what we do need to do is make public the information of the kind of work that's being done.
That was Dr. Barbara Hatch Rosenberg of the Federation of American Scientists. The Federation's website is www.fas.org. That's www.fasinfrank.org. The importance of having oversight and weapons inspections in the United States was underscored on November 11, 2002. On that day, about 200 people gathered at the gates of Lawrence Livermore National Lab to deliver a formal request to Lab Director Michael Anastasio that a citizens group be allowed to enter the facilities and inspect them for signs of nuclear and biological weapons development. The Citizens Inspection Team, made up of representatives of peace advocacy organizations from throughout California, used language excerpted from the UN Security Council Resolution 1441 on Iraq, requesting immediate, unimpeded, unconditional, and unrestricted access to the lab. Richard Levitt of Berkeley radio station KPFA was there.
Some self-proclaimed citizen weapons inspectors gathered, along with a group of 200 or so peace and anti-nuclear advocates, at the gates of Lawrence Livermore Lab, demanding access to what they claim are development labs for nuclear and biological weapons. Mary Lee Kelly is the executive director of Tri-Valley Cares, an organization that has been monitoring activity at Lawrence Livermore for over 20 years. She says weapons of mass destruction are being developed there in spite of government claims that the main activities are maintenance and monitoring.
A small percentage of the budget and programs here at the laboratory go toward the actual physical maintenance and monitoring of the weapon stockpile. The vast majority of the budget and programs here at Livermore Lab are involved in the continued design and modification of nuclear weapons, including the new so-called bunker-busting nuclear weapon called for by the Bush administration.
Speakers from the 30 or so groups on hand had a chance at the mic to voice an opinion or rouse the crowd. Meanwhile, the crowd grew. Costumed, self-appointed inspectors milled around wearing homemade radiation-resistant jumpsuits, civil defense helmets, and masks, and displaying many signs with variations on the themes of disarmament, inspection, and peace. Barry Lafsky stated his position while fussing with pockets full of neon green goop, which he claimed to be recovered nuclear materials.
We demand the UN inspections of the U.S. nuclear facilities. We demand that they respect international law and don't invade Iraq.
Now, do you expect to be allowed free and unfettered access today?
I would imagine that they won't let me pass that bunch of armed guards.
But you're going to ask.
I'm certainly going to ask.
Pat Mahoney from the Catholic Worker held a 12-foot peace banner facing drivers on Vasco Road.
We oppose nuclear weapons and bombings and all that because the only way you can help people is by feeding them and loving them and making it possible for people to be able to live peacefully.
After about 90 minutes of speeches, the chief weapons inspectors, Jacqueline Cabasso, Tara Dorobji, James Long, and Peter Fehrenbach led the group toward the gates of the lab, and the line of 30 unamused riot cops lined up between them and the entrance. Cabasso then presented their request for access.
Are you here to accept a letter that we wish to deliver to Michael Anastasio?
Will do.
David Schwegler of the lab's public affairs office stepped up, grabbed the envelope, and just as quickly turned his back on the group. Undaunted, Cabasso read her statement.
This is a letter in which we demand the right to immediate, unimpeded, unconditional, and unrestricted access to any and all, including underground areas, facilities, buildings, equipment, records, and means of transport that we may wish to inspect, as well as private access to all officials and other persons whom we wish to interview in the mode or location of our choice. That is the exact language that's in UN Resolution 1441 that is going to be applied to Iraq. Will you let us come and inspect?
The spokesperson has run away.
Spokesperson has run away.
By this time, Schwegler was long gone, and the riot cops showed no signs of letting the inspectors in. Cabasso continued.
Are you going to let us in to inspect? We have a list of facilities here that we know about, the plutonium facility, the tritium facility, the Uranium Manufacturing and Process Development Facility, the National Ignition Facility, Advanced Simulation and Computing Facilities, including the ASCII White and Blue Pacific Supercomputers, the High Explosives Application Facility, the Hardin Test Facility, the Flash X-ray Contained Firing Facility, the Biosafety Level 2 Laboratory and proposed site for the BSL-3 Laboratory, the Conflict Simulation Laboratory, the International Assessment Center. Will you let us inspect these facilities?
It was clear nobody was getting in, but Cabasso continued stating their disinterest in conflict, but their commitment to the cause.
We expect an answer in writing from Michael Anastasio, the laboratory director, and we will come back again.
We'll be back!
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 Their statement made, the group backed off. As they dispersed, Cabasso reflected on the event.
I have no expectation that it's going to make any difference whatsoever to the military-industrial institution that runs this laboratory. However, we did attract some media attention, and we did attract a very large crowd of participants from a very diverse range of groups. And so in that sense, I think it is definitely highlighting the incredible U.S. hypocrisy with respect to the situation in Iraq.
The entire group of protesters was then invited to a nearby location to enjoy some refreshments, debrief, and make plans for future actions.
And that was Richard Levitt of radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California, reporting from the gates of the Lawrence Livermore National Lab. Anthrax is an organism that can be used in both a BSL-2 or BSL-3 lab, depending on the circumstances. When Lawrence Livermore refused to provide a spokesperson to KPFA for a story on the proposed lab, they instead sent a 3-page list of frequently asked questions. The list contained the question, "Will we conduct research involving anthrax in the BSL-3 facility?" The answer was, quote, "Yes. In fact, We have been working with 25 different strains of anthrax since spring 2000 as part of our regular program work for the National Nuclear Security Administration's Chemical and Biological National Security Program. In close cooperation with the CDC, the work with small amounts of anthrax has been conducted without incident and in full compliance with all applicable safety, security, and administrative requirements. Unquote. That the lab has worked without incident with small amounts of anthrax in the past is no guarantee that there will be no incidents in the future. To err is human, after all. And what if anthrax is released into the San Francisco Bay Area or any place else where anthrax is being experimented on? After all, we still have not resolved the matter of who perpetrated the anthrax attacks in the fall of 2001. Though, as political assassinations researcher John Judge suggested in a lecture in Oakland, clues point to someone or someones in the U.S. government.
On the 4th and the 5th, there were articles in the London Sunday Times and the New York Times, and they had to do with two operations, one called Clear Vision and the other called Operation Jefferson. I don't know if you've heard of either of these. These were being conducted out at White Sands Proving Grounds and also with some military contractors. They were both CIA and DIA-related operations. Clear Vision was to do two things. It was try to create a lab with things that you could order through the Internet and samples that you could order through commercial sources to create anthrax. In other words, to grow cultures of anthrax in a laboratory that you could get to see if the terrorists could do it. The other operation was to see if terrorists could create and smuggle an anthrax bomb into the United States. And so they actually created a bomb, although they said later it didn't have a detonator and it didn't have any anthrax, that they brought this bomb and smuggled it in as a test to see whether terrorists could do this. Now, these things coming out caused an international flap because technically they're not supposed to be testing weapons or even potential weapons relating to chemical biological warfare. It's against treaties that they've signed. And so these secret operations were exposed on September the 4th and the 5th. But the more important one, Operation Jefferson, came from Rumsfeld himself. When he came into office, he ordered the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Pentagon to create the next generation of anthrax, to create an anthrax that would be genetically modified, be more lethal, be more resistant to the antibiotics, and be more distributable through its weaponization. And this is a direct violation of those treaties, to create a new weapon and a new kind of anthrax that would be harder to stop. And yet, they went ahead with these plans, and on September the 6th, the Defense Intelligence Agency had a press conference in D.C. where they announced that they not only had created but were ready to test a new generation of anthrax. That's on September the 6th. And this was all in the public press. And it was causing some flap, but generally the press just go and stick the microphone up there and they don't ask questions. We have anthrax attacks just as everybody's starting to come down from 9/11, and we have anthrax attacks. Do the terrorists go after Bush? Do they go after Rumsfeld? Do they go after Cheney? Do they go after the Republican leadership in the Congress who's carrying on the war against Afghanistan? No. Where do they send them? The first place to get an anthrax envelope, as you may remember, is the tabloid headquarters in Florida. When I first read that, I thought, well, you know, the tabloids are a CIA propaganda tool anyway. I figured this is a false story, but the guy actually dies. He's a photo editor. But it's just another coincidence. He's a photo editor at the tabloids who happened to be the photo editor that first put in pictures of Bush's daughters being arrested for drunk driving. It's just a coincidence. Okay, then where do they go? They go to Rather and Brokaw up at NBC and the national news networks. That's who they scare next. And I'm no friend of them. I know Rather was part of the lies in the Kennedy assassination. But relative to the current scope of discussion, these are liberals in the media, okay? Because the discussion has shifted so far to the right that it's a debate between an open fascist and a moderate conservative, which means that a liberal is what a commie was in the 50s, and it means I'm so far over there to the left, I'm a terrorist, all right? And the rest of us probably in the room. You know, you look like terrorists to me anyway. We are outside the government, and we have less power. We are only able to wage asymmetrical warfare, and we're fighting for justice. However we fight, we're terrorists, even if we don't use weapons within that framework. So, and then the main opponents of the Bush domestic agenda get envelopes, Daschle and Leahy and a spillover to Feingold. And also the main opponents up till that day of the U.S. Patriot Act. who were questioning the U.S. Patriot Act up until they got the anthrax envelopes. And what's in the envelopes? An anthrax that's so sophisticated, they said it couldn't have been developed in the Soviet Union or the United States. They said, what's left? Outer space? Who else is left to develop something? But, you know, let's not admit it could come from here. It hasn't got any aluminum tracings. It's not from Iraq. We do the chemical tests on it. And then we do a DNA test on it. And lo and behold, it's Ames strain anthrax. That means it's U.S. anthrax. It means it comes from the most common place that anthrax comes from in the United States, University of Iowa at Ames, who maintained an archive of every known strain of anthrax. Anthrax is a natural disease. It's zoonotic. It passes from animals to humans. It's a farm disease. They've known about it since the 1920s. They took every strain and also tested those strains for antibiotics and other responses on those strains. And there's a whole archive kept of small samples so that they can be cultured and used. And there's a paper trail. So if you want this particular strain of anthrax from this particular batch, you send it out and there's a paper trail. Who experimented on it? Who ordered it? 10 days before the envelopes are sent, the FBI calls the University of Iowa at Ames and tells them to destroy the archive after 70 years, which means that we know it came from Ames, but we don't know from what batch. We can't tell from what batch. And without knowing from what batch, we can't tell where it went to, even though there was a paper trail before they destroyed it. The FBI called 10 days before and had the batch destroyed. That was in the New York Times, the bungling FBI. When they looked at this anthrax, they said, this is like nothing we've ever seen. There's a trillion spores per gram. It had been 1 to 2 billion spores per gram in the previously weaponized anthrax. It's also so distributable, so fluffy, which means it's got no electromagnetic bonding on these individual spores, that anything will spread it. You know, the wind will spread it. It spreads like hell. And it's more lethal. Now, what does that match? Is that the next generation of anthrax that I told you about, that it was ready to test on September the 6th? I think it is. And then they not only went to Ames, it suddenly became clear that it had been weaponized through Fort Detrick. And the investigation went to the gate of Fort Detrick, and it stopped dead. For months, we didn't hear anything about the anthrax investigation. And now what do we hear? It's one lone nut. It's, again, a lone nut that did this. Only that's falling apart. The evidence they have on this guy is not holding.
And that was political assassinations researcher John Judge. More of his remarks are in the first RISE program, 9/11 and New Wars, which can be downloaded at the RISE website, www.riseFornews.net. That's RISE, the number 4, news.net. You are listening to RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. I'm Kelia Romaris. Today's topic is bioterrorism, looking in the mirror. Dr. Robert Gould is an associate pathologist at Santa Teresa Community Hospital in San Jose, California. He is president of the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. In January 2003, he becomes national president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, which represents more than 20,000 physicians, nurses, healthcare professionals, and concerned citizens devoted to nuclear disarmament, violence prevention, and environmental health. RISE had an extended conversation with Dr. Gould about the proliferation of high-containment biological research labs in the United States.
All right, doctor, scare me. What are they going to do in a BSL-3 facility?
Well, in the BSL-3 and 4 facility are the types of facilities that will be handling potentially very virulent organisms. The putative reason for doing this is to be able to do defensive biological work, such as developing new vaccines and other modalities that are supposed to protect us from a bioterrorist attack or from exotic infectious diseases. The problems that a number of us have in terms of these programs is that they're proceeding very rapidly throughout the country, one lab at a time, without a real overview of what the overall programmatic implications of this whole process are. And this includes what exactly is going to be the nature of the work, what are the nature of the organisms that are going to be handled. The concerns include having labs handling potentially very dangerous organisms near urban areas, such as the Lawrence Livermore lab, where there are concerns about the possible escape of organisms into the community or workers coming down with the diseases from the organisms that they're handling. This is not a theoretical problem. In terms of the possible accidents, the Department of Energy itself issued a report at the beginning of last year that indicated problems with mishandling agents and the misidentifying agents in a number of facilities of the Department of Energy that at the time were involved with this sort of thing. In addition, a worker at Fort Detrick, which is one of the premier biological labs, again, supposedly working on just defensive research in Maryland, came down with a case of glanders where he was out in the community. It wasn't known until he was out in the community. Luckily, he did okay, and nobody in the community acquired the infection. But it gives concern about whether there are more dangers from working with these organisms in dispersed labs than the real objective threat posed by bioterrorism. The other issue, of course, is in relationship to this set of problems, is the fact that in the wake of the anthrax outbreak of last year, it's still unclear how that occurred, although there's been a lot of evidence implicating the possibility of somebody on the inside of the nation's biological labs being involved with the dispersal of anthrax. So there's always the vulnerability of people who, terrorists or whatever, handling agents and getting a hold of them and possibly representing a threat to the community as well. I'm personally, as well as many of my colleagues, concerned with larger issues, if you will. Last year in September, a week before September 11th, it was revealed in the front page articles in the New York Times and in a number of articles that followed this about the fact that the United States was involved in research that may have crossed the line between defensive and offensive work. I would want to remind people that there are many weaknesses and loopholes in the current Biological Weapons Convention that have a blurred line between defensive and offensive work. And certainly we raise all the time accusations of other countries, including Iraq, that if they're working on with certain organisms, that it portends an offensive biological warfare capability. We have to look at our own practice and see if some of the programs that we have might be threatening a violation of that as well. And what was revealed in the New York Times were a number of things. One was that the United States was developing plans to genetically modify anthrax. We said, our government said, that this was for purely defensive reasons, although I would submit that, again, if other countries were doing the same, and the allegations have been made that other countries, like scientists in the former Soviet Union, were working on similar type of projects, that this is, again, a threat of developing offensive capabilities, because you're modifying an organism to be resistant to antibiotics and therefore increasing its capability to be a weapon. One of the other revelations that came out at the time is that the United States had developed a prototype germ facility at the Nevada test site. Again, we claimed it was for defensive reasons, but both of these projects were done in secret and completely out of the sort of international norms of transparency that are supposed to guide so-called biological defense work. Now, this comes at a time when the United States itself has been rather rogue compared with the rest of the world in being the lone country to scuttle global efforts to strengthen the Biological Weapons Convention because of the problems that I've outlined in terms of the very blurred gray line between defense and offense. The rest of the countries of the world wanted to do a number of things. They wanted to have a strengthened verification and inspection regime, which could go all the way up to challenge inspections that are done very quickly because of the knowledge that one doesn't need many organisms, virulent organisms, to develop a offensive biological weapons capability. This was mightily resisted by the pharmaceutical companies and the biotech firms, U.S. pharmaceutical and biotech firms, because they said that such vigorous on-site inspections would threaten U.S. proprietary rights. It's interesting in this regard that the counterparts, the European pharmaceutical and biotech firms, did not have problems with this type of inspection regime. The other thing that's of note is that, of course, a strengthened Biological Weapons Convention would also uncover the sorts of projects that the United States government has been operating as well, like those revealed in the New York Times. What makes this especially egregious to me is that at the same time, while the biotech and pharmaceutical companies are rejecting a global effort to strengthen the conventions for against biological weapons, that these same companies are getting all these multi-million-dollar contracts, Homeland Security contracts, and the rest of the monies that are coming out of bioterrorism to basically cash in on this type of concern about bioterrorism by developing high-end vaccines and other high-tech products, incapacitating foams for organisms, whatever, that to me and to many of my colleagues in PSR and elsewhere is not the most effective way to deal with the threat of biological illness, whether it arises, quote-unquote, spontaneously, what we call emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases, or would be one that would be intentionally introduced.
About the bugs themselves, with names and names, what are we talking about they're working on?
Well, we already know, again, from revealed in the New York Times, that they were working on, or planning to work on, that's how they phrase these things, on genetically modified anthrax. Other agents that have been talked about, again, always under the rubric of developing vaccines, include those agents that we have considered would have utility for biological weapons. So we're talking about botulism organisms. We're talking about a variety of viruses such as Ebola virus, those types of exotic viruses that cause encephalitis of varying types, rickettsial organisms. There's a whole list of organisms that, for example, Lawrence Livermore has listed as possible agents that they would use in a facility at Livermore. One of the problems that we have is that they have a loophole, if you will, that there may be other agents which they're not listing at this point. I mean, a lot of the problems is that whatever agents that they're working on, including the known pathogens, is that the technology has advanced to the point in biotech that the capacity for genetically modifying organisms, you know, through genetic engineering, whatever, has proceeded to a point that poses extreme danger if those projects are not getting adequate review and control. Examples of those dangers include the fact it was reported, for example, a number of months ago, that scientists, supposedly just to test the system, had been able to, through just getting pieces of genetic material on the market, develop a synthetic polio organism just by putting it together. A year or two ago, it was reported that scientists working in British labs had violated British lab norms by creating a synthetic organism that was a synthesis of dengue fever and hepatitis, which would have a virulence far greater than, say, the AIDS virus. And it was also reported last year that in Australia, some people working with mousepox virus in order to develop what is called boosting innate immunity, the body's more primitive way of developing an immune response as opposed to applying specific vaccines, had developed an extremely virulent virus there that would have been extremely deadly if it got out of the lab. So these are some of the dangers that we have. I mean, a lot of this is pretty unknown. We don't really know what they're thinking. This has all been kept fairly top secret under the sort of national security regime that's being instituted.
And that is the problem, isn't it? I mean, you can understand that maybe we don't want an enemy to know that we have an antidote to what they're planning, but on the other hand, it seems to me that if you are going to work on something, say, to find out how it works because you genuinely want to defend against it, that you then know how it works so you can use it as a weapon, right?
Well, that's the major problem. You know, one has to question, what is all this work about? I mean, as a physician, I know, we know, that if you apply a vaccine to a specific agent, you'll get immunity to that if the vaccine works, but there's going to be a lag time. But if you're starting to genetically modify organisms, which the U.S. has always said that other countries were doing, then to immunize you, say, against anthrax A isn't going to help you if you're going to get hit with genetically modified organisms. So it could be argued that if it's known that you're giving a vaccine to troops or civilians for a certain organism. It only would lead somebody, if they were truly bent on attacking us, to hit us with either a more virulent strain or one that's been genetically modified to overcome vaccines. I mean, vaccines are not a good defense in general, I would say, against terrorist assaults, particularly since many organisms are not readily treated with vaccines. And certainly if you're going to be dealing with antibiotics, they're only going to treat bacteria. They're not going to be effective against viruses. So one thing that one would hope for is that any research that's done, putatively defensive, because that is all that they're supposed to do. They're not supposed to make weapons under the Biological Weapons Convention as it exists right now. You should have a completely open and transparent process so no one is thinking that anybody else is working on dangerous organisms, or else you get the sort of biological arms race which the whole convention is supposed to forestall.
To what extent are medical doctors involved in this process? We know there's microbiologists, but I would think that most medical doctors would find the whole process abhorrent, and yet if they're not involved, then, you know, how do you protect the public?
Well, I don't know how many physicians are aware of, say, the work that's going on or proposed for the biological safety labs. I would say that physicians like, my own colleagues are certainly concerned and ready to do what they can as physicians to treat the ill if there should be some sort of attack. I mean, we have, for example, at my own hospital, some preparation in order if something equivalent to a small-scale anthrax attack occurs or other infectious outbreak. It makes sense to organize and have some plans in place at the community hospital level. But, you know, a massive attack, I think we're deluding ourselves to think that we would be able to deal with this. And I think most physicians would know that we wouldn't be capable either, despite the propaganda that comes out, because the system would get overwhelmed. And in that sense, it's very akin to preparedness for nuclear war, which led Physicians for Social Responsibility in the 1960s to write articles in the New England Journal and elsewhere saying that, yes, you know, we need to treat the ill, but in a way we would delude the public that we could respond on a truly catastrophic basis. And I think there's a lot of dissension among physicians as well as public health people, although it's not manifested at the top leadership, say in the Centers for Disease Control, over some of the plans for smallpox vaccination that have been coming to the fore. Initially, a number of months ago, before what I would submit the issue became much more politicized by the designs of military intelligence, whatever, there was planned to do a ring strategy, which would mean that if somebody got sick with smallpox, you would inoculate those people who were in direct contact, basically a ring around people, and that would be how you'd control it, and that would be an effective way of responding. And the reason for that was, A, there was no real hard evidence of a likely smallpox attack, despite the proliferation of scary stories by, you know, various writers and people working for the government, say. And the other thing was that the smallpox vaccine itself has been reported in the press, at least the current one, has a significant downside. You know, there's a significant proportion of people will get encephalitis, which is an inflammation of the brain from getting the vaccine, with a percentage of those dying. And there are other effects for the population that have a psoriasis that can get significant viral infections that themselves, although cutaneously or, you know, gotten through the skin, can lead to a certain degree of morbidity and mortality. And, of course, we have a much larger immune-compromised population in the United States than the era when I was vaccinated against smallpox back in the 1950s. So you get a situation where the government is now saying, oh, yeah, it's cool, you know, let's make it voluntary, or, you know, we'll inoculate you, Dr. Gould, so you're prepared to handle bioterrorist casualties at your hospital. But then I go home to San Francisco, and I get on the Muni, and I have a live viral vaccination. And how many people with AIDS or otherwise immune compromised in San Francisco will come down with the disease because I've either taken it voluntarily or been pressed to do it to serve our country, so to speak?
And to make it worse, they're claiming it's voluntary, but in fact they are trying to pass the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act that could make it mandatory.
That's right. And I don't think there's a lot of thought given on how you'd do this in a way that would protect the public from the you know, beyond the obvious civil liberties issues that you're raising, that there are any real plans to truly protect the public, particularly the very vulnerable populations that we have. And again, that's measured against a threat that is largely politically derived. You know, the other thing is, if I would make one major point, and one which I've made in conjunction with colleagues such as Dr. Victor Seidel and Hillel Cohen at Montefiore Medical Center, New York, when we've written a number of articles raising these questions for the American Journal of Public Health and other journals, is that if you're really looking at infectious disease or bioterrorism, and this is a point that actually was taken up as policy by the American Public Health Association, that effective protection really has to look at preparedness for bioterrorism under the larger rubric of protection against all what are called emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases. And that good public health practice means that you're not relying on vaccinations and antibiotics and all this sort of reactive type of process for disease, but you look at what we call primary prevention. The elements of primary prevention in this case are a number of issues. Number one, we've already talked about issues of strengthening the conventions that can control the likely use of a terrorist weapon. So our government should go back to the table with the rest of the countries in Geneva and have the strongest possible biological weapons convention possible, not be leaving it because of, again, the selfish interests of the biotech and pharmaceutical firms or our own desires to develop offensive capabilities, as is illustrated, I think, by some of our plans. But more fundamental than that, we have to look at what are the real threats to the global community from infectious disease. And the basic elements of providing protection are adequate food, nutrition, and housing, medical care, not just here in the United States, which of course has over 40 million uninsured people, but around the world. So the biggest infectious disease threats, and this is substantiated by Dr. Norman Neureiter, who is the head scientific and health advisor to the State Department in an article that came out in the New York Times last year, who said that what we need to be thinking about is, for example, AIDS in Africa, the reservoir within AIDS of antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis, not just within the AIDS population, but, say, in prisons in Eastern Europe and areas like that where this is spreading. If you look at AIDS, for example, Kofi Annan of the United Nations said that we would need $10 billion a year to deal with this. And the United States, earlier in the year or the end of last year, pledged somewhere in the order of $200 million, which is basically chump change for the needs of combating AIDS, you know, the real global needs. I would also indicate that the $10 billion that is needed per year to deal with AIDS is equivalent to what the United States counterterrorism budget was per year prior to 9/11. Given an example of our distorted priorities and where we're spending our money, particularly in an era where the military budget has been increased anywhere from $40 to $50 billion, not including potential costs of possible war in Iraq. Another example of these trade-offs is that there was a United Nations report about a year and a half ago or 2 years ago that indicated that the same $10 billion a year that we were spending on counterterrorism could provide enough clean water and sanitation for people in the world to cut by up to one-third the 4 billion cases of infectious diarrhea a year that caused 2 million deaths around the world. So when we're talking about deaths from the disease, these comparisons really, you know, show where the priorities really should be. And an additional factor on this, and something that is not talked about by our leaders in the Centers for Disease Control, is like this is the same government that while it's kicking every treaty in the teeth, including the Biological Weapons Convention, and including the rejection of the Kyoto Accords, there's accumulating evidence that there's going to be a significant rise in infectious disease from climate change. So you have people like Dr. Julie Gerberding, the head of the CDC, saying it's okay to spray all these pesticides in Louisiana, and you see pictures in the press that look like the old DDT spraying of the 1950s, saying it's all right because, you know, we have to deal with West Nile virus, but not having the courage to say, well, you know, if West Nile virus is arising, maybe that's a reflection of the change in the climate that's allowing the mosquitoes and this new disease to spread. And maybe they should be calling on our president to start thinking again as primary prevention to do something about global climate change. It's been estimated by the World Health Organization, for example, that by the end of next century, we may have anywhere from 50 to 80 million additional cases of malaria as a result of this change, because there's an increase in the life cycle of the Anopheles mosquito and the Plasmodium organism that causes malaria with increased climate change. So you begin to see malaria in new altitudes and more northerly latitudes than had been seen before. And this is just one example of the sort of changes that we see afoot. All this stuff is getting lost in this type of very high-end, very militarized preparation against biological assaults.
And then the thing is that they want to talk about it being defensive. But what if really this is about wanting to have it weaponized, wanting to dominate the world with biological weapons?
Well, I think that's one of the issues that we have to look at. You know, there's no proof of that at this point, but certainly, as was raised in the Times about the United States plans in, you know, the week before September 11th, that some of these plans certainly presage a possible offensive weapons capability on the part of the United States. Certainly, Elihu Harris, who had been the main advisor to the Clinton administration on biological proliferation issues, raised these concerns, as has Barbara Rosenberg, who's the lead scientist on biological weapons issues with the Federation of American Scientists. So, yeah, that's a significant problem. The other issue, of course, is the issue of having a biological weapons race overall that would be engendered by this. And the other thing, which I actually think is more short-term, if you will, in terms of military capability, is not necessarily the use of the weapons as offensive agents, but to the degree that one has to even look at defensive research as having possible offensive capabilities, in the sense that inoculating troops, this is the current plan to inoculate something like 500,000 U.S. troops against smallpox, enables them to be able to fight in what the military calls unconventional contexts. You have now a situation that there have been a lot of claims, and it might be true that Saddam Hussein has some biological and maybe chemical weapons capacity. And as you may recall, it was about a week and a half ago, George Tenet, the director of the CIA, actually issued a report that said that Saddam Hussein, being whoever he is, whatever one thinks about him, if one thing, he's a man who's bent on his own survival, and he did not use such weapons in an offensive way when there's been a lot of evidence that he probably was developing the weapons during the first Gulf War, because to do so would have been basically to spell the end for him in terms of what the reaction might have been, including nuclear at the time. So I think countries who develop such weapons of mass destruction, including the Iraqis, if they are, would use them in a use them or lose them type of situation. So the assessment of the CIA was that he's unlikely to use such agents, but like if we're going to war with him and he has nothing left to lose, he may very well fire off some scuds at Israel or at U.S. troops. So it was basically, if you will, a cornering a rat scenario where he's faced with this type of situation. So the United States then has a choice. Are we going to go to war or not? Are we going to have diplomatic ways to cool the situation or not? But if we're inoculating our troops, by inoculating our troops against smallpox, we then prepare them for the ability to fight in that situation. So as opposed to saying, gee, this wouldn't be a good situation to go to war because even the CIA is saying in a last desperate move he may fire off some weapons, we instead say, let's go to war, and to, in order to protect our troops maximally, let's start inoculating them against anthrax and smallpox. So we then, and a lot of this quote-unquote defensive work may be truly defensive in that sense, but it allows the troops to operate offensively in a hostile environment where such agents would be used. It's not saying it's perfect. It's not saying it would even protect the majority of the troops, because we don't know what the Iraqis may have used. But one of the cardinal features of defensive work on biological weapons since the 1950s, if you look at all the old documents, was indeed to prepare troops to be able to operate in battle situations where such weapons might be used by the other side.
Okay, that leaves me to one other thought here, and that is that the bug isn't going to stay on the battlefield. Let's say we did that, inoculate people for smallpox, and Saddam, let's say, did do something desperate, that bug that he uses is not necessarily going to just die out within the confines of the theater of operations.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, yeah. It could go into the Iraqi civilians. If he places them in Scuds. It can go to Israel. It could lead to a chain reaction where Israel then has been given the green light to respond with its nuclear arsenal. So, you know, it has a danger both in terms of the direct spread of organisms in such contexts as well as the action-reaction sequence of going up the ladder to nuclear. So there are a lot of levels of danger, both in terms of the weapons themselves as well as the arsenals that are poised to quote-unquote respond.
That was Dr. Robert Gould of Physicians for Social Responsibility. The organization's web address is www.psr.org. That's www.psrandsamr.org. Dr. Gould's concern about the United States genetically modifying organisms are borne out by the draft environmental assessment for the proposed Lawrence Livermore BSL-3 lab. The assessment says that current plans call for the facility to handle the DNA and RNA of a wide array of organisms. The assessment also listed several processes that could be done in the lab. One such process involves the chemical separation of DNA, RNA, and proteins. Another process, called sample amplification, is, quote, the process to rapidly and significantly increase the number of microorganisms in a sample, unquote. You know, like making anthrax that's a trillion spores per gram. As I record this near midnight on December 16, 2002, the weapons inspectors in Iraq have still not found anything to write home about. The U.S. government maintains Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, but still refuses to release any evidence backing up its claims. Earlier this week, the comic strip Doonesbury lampooned the White House position by having weapons inspectors go to a yogurt factory and find radioactive yogurt. The series of strips ended with the factory being cleared of any wrongdoing. The yogurt was radioactive because the cows that provided the milk had been drinking radioactive water, a reference to American use of depleted uranium during the Persian Gulf War. You've been listening to Rise, Radio Internet Story Exchange, a weekly public affairs program helping you to ask questions, find answers, and distinguish the truth from the lie. Rise is taking a couple of weeks off. Our next program will be January 6th. Season's greetings to all our listeners. Rise is produced by myself, Kelly O'Ramaris, partially at the studios of radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California. The Rise website is www.riseforNews.net. That's Rise, the number 4, news.net. Archived programs may be reached through that site. Radio Internet Story Exchange is now heard on Love Underground Visionary Revolution on Fridays, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, at luver.com or .org. That's lover, luver.com or .org. Rise is also in rotation at the news stream of Party Town Streaming Network, www.partytown.com/radio. That's partytown.com/radio. Radio Internet Story Exchange receives no corporate or foundation funding and depends on you for support. For more information on how to donate to RISE, receive or publicize the program, please email Kellia at riseforNews.net. That's K-E-L-L-I-A at RISE, the number 4, news.net. This has been RISE, Radio Internet Story Exchange. Thanks for listening.